Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, ho, 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 howdy. Mostly a very merry and happy holiday season to you all. This will be the, the Christmas edition of The Horn. We played a little Christmas music along the way, but not a lot. And I have a confession to make. You know, looking back over the years, I'm really not good at doing holiday-specific programs. Among other things, because it's not in my nature to foist off whatever it is I feel about something on y'all. I figure it, well, so simply let me say, it is our fondest hope and good wish from all of us here that you have happiness in abundance here as the old year turns around. And the sun gets a little stronger day by day and is reborn. Solstice was a couple of days ago. This is, of course, the 23rd of December. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. And a reminder that December the 23rd marks, as I learned from... As I learned from an article sent along by our good buddy Reverbo, December 23rd is the date that secularists celebrate a winter holiday called the Human Light Holiday, Human Light Festival. So I'm keeping that in mind. I have to admit I was out and about a little bit today picking up some groceries and so forth for the feast on Sunday. And Jiminy! I mean, in the grocery store, it was like Lord of the Flies in there. Grim-faced people going from aisle to aisle, taking things off the shelves and standing in line and oy. And of course, a friend of mine told me that late last night, they have a police scanner. Late last night, the police bandwidth was taken up with nothing but, they have a shoplifter at Walmart. One Adam 12, shoplifter at Walmart. Get Joe Friday, shoplifter at Walmart. Apparently it was foraging night at Walmart. And it'll only be more fun, as Saturday comes on and we get closer and closer to Christmas. But I do. I hope you all have a magnificent, Christmas or holiday, however it is that you celebrate it. We will observe one tradition this evening. We'll play some Christmas music. Just because, well, I do like it. I mean, it's the tradition I was raised in. It's hard to get away from. We'll play some Christmas music tonight. We will also, toward the end of the program, Ferg and Doodle and Margie will, I hope. They're teenagers now, so you can't necessarily count on anything being for certain. That comes with the whole turning into teenagers thing, I think. But Ferg and Margie and Doodle will come in here for what has become a tradition, something that they have been doing for a lot of years now, basically for as long as they've been reading, I think. If you go back and look at listen to the last show before Christmas over the last number of years that we've been engaged in this little exercise, this being, the sixth or the seventh? Can't remember. That's what we do toward the end of end of the program every show immediately before Christmas, sometimes Christmas Eve, sometimes the 23rd. Hard to tell. I hope you'll enjoy it. It's been, for us as parents here, it provides a sort of a time capsule of what it can be like. You may recall that last year Doodle sang, and Ferg played something on his keyboard, I think. I don't think he's got anything ready for this evening. He noodled around a little bit last Friday night and did an excellent job, especially for a kid who's never sat for a lesson. But we will have ourselves a merry little Christmas on Sunday, and hope that you do as well. I had a brief phone conversation with our good friend Maura, who called before showtime to wish us all a merry Christmas, and I told her she's been such an absolutely dedicated, long-time supporter of these efforts, as have so many of you. I mentioned to her something that in truth will happen before anyone digs into the Whoville roast beast or whatever it is. We do this every year. Of course, you're not present for it because we're not broadcasting at the time. But we will lift a glass, and we will offer a toast to what Bob Cratchit, as Bob Cratchit referred to, the founder of the feast. There will be no goose, of course, upon the table, because I guess geese aren't allowed to be served in West Virginia or something. I went looking, but so we'll stay with the old traditions. News Ninja Susan wanted to know, any chance of an addition to your reading this year? Not that I can think of, no. I mean, I don't know if you're talking about topicality or people reading or anything. I don't know. I had just planned to do the story out of Luke and Matthew and sort of keep with things the way they were. But no, before the feast on Christmas Day, we will lift a glass, because it is so entirely right and proper that we do so, and a manifestation of love and respect going out to y'all, to all of you who, by your ideas, by your comments, by your contributions of both energy, time, and yes, money, have kept this going for so long. This is a reflective time of year. I don't think it can be helped. And for me to look back and realize that by hook or by crook, sometimes by nothing more than sheer grit and determination, sometimes by tears, sometimes in laughter, we've kept this thing going longer and actually, you know, have been more successful than operations with more to do with. And that is a testament to your determination and not to mine. Because as we reflect on things that really matter at this time of year, well, if I was just sitting here babbling into a microphone with no sense that it meant anything to anyone, it wouldn't be worth doing. It's the notes, it's the commentary that comes from you that gives real meaning and content to this effort. It's the efforts poured out by our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Susan, who gets a show post up for me every day. Gene, who reads the entire internet every day. Our blogger, Texas Betsy, who is forever providing me both with content and with encouragement, even in the darkest of times. Reverbo, who brings us laughter, but who also brings us a sense of perspective for exactly where we are. My head writer, David in Tennessee. I call him my head writer, but he's ever so much more than that. Simply put, he is one of my very best friends on the planet, and provides much-needed laughter and observations that often plumb escape me. And, of course, that leaves John Fox and Ben Burch, and this wouldn't happen without them. None of this would go out without the ongoing, tireless, heroic efforts of Ben Burch at the White Rose Society and John Fox's patient ability to say, Bob, calm down, take a breath, it'll be okay. We've just got a button pushed wrong somewhere, or maybe a dry join in the socket. It's okay, Bob, it's going to be all right. So thank you to all of you. I can't, if I started naming names, I would miss one, and I would thereby feel terrible in the process for having left someone off. But thank you to each and every one of you for however many ways you make this happen, because we're going forward over the years and we're proving that one need not rely on the 1% for-profit media in order for us to have a dialogue about the needs of this country, the future of this country, the positioning of this country between the past and its future. Thank you. Thank you, one and all.
God bless us, everyone.
Right. So, with all of that having been said, I got to tell you, I feel a little funny about jumping into just the ordinary, tawdry day-to-day stories. But you know, that's what this program is. We deal with the day-to-day. We deal with the stories that affect us, that sometimes horrify us, shock us, and that sometimes we just look at and say, well, you know, that's the way right-wingers are. I guess they'll be trying to have a happy Christmas this year. But in terms of, for instance, in terms of Christmas music, Ferg actually started learning the strum pattern and stuff to this song. The time proved too short. Maybe by next year, I don't know. But I'm going to tell you, we'll start out with this one little tune, simply because for the first time, this song was written as a commemoration of another period of time, another part of history. And for the first time in a long time, it can marginally be said to be true of us today. And I'm talking, of course, about John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Happy Christmas, War is Over from 1975. The Vietnam conflict, the Vietnam horror, the Vietnam attempted, partial genocide had finally come to a close. And with that happening, John Lennon released a song noting the end of that conflict. So with that in mind, we'll take a little time and perhaps listen to it with an aim to remember the horrors that have been perpetrated since 2003 by a man who to this day has never been compelled to face justice. Man, men, women, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, creepy Paul Wolfowitz with his comb in his mouth, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Alberto Gonzalez, Crisco John Ashcroft, that whole revolting bunch. Well, this is Christmassy, isn't it? Sorry. But no, they've never faced justice. And over, and yes, it is, yes, there are still going to be troops on the ground there, I know it. And yes, there are going to be tons of Blackwater and Wacken Hut mercenaries still bleeding us of blood and treasure. And I guess there's always the possibility we will turn around and go back, but I'd like to hope that we won't. Baghdad is, of course, exploding again. You saw the news about what happened there with the bombings yesterday. And I'm sure there are right-wingers that say, see, we left too soon. We tried to tell you. But the fact of the matter is, Iraq was going to erupt regardless of when we left, because of the vacuum that we created and the instability that we imposed upon that poor, poor blasted nation with our shock and awe of 2003. We did it. We have to deal with it. And there will be a moral and ethical price to pay, perhaps a karmic price to pay, that will linger on and on and on. Veterans with problems unaddressed, post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, limbs missing, you know. But at least this year, we can say that officially, it's over. And there's a great deal of value. There's a great deal of relief. And especially for those whose families were torn to shreds by us, by the United States, perhaps a little bit of relief. So, yeah, and it is absolutely one of my favorite Christmas tunes, just because it has more to it than the usual snowfall over moonlit snow kind of. No, this is as much about Christmas as it is a Christmas song, and it's about how people look at Christmas. So we'll play this, and then eventually I guess maybe we will get into some of the sad and tawdry business of just the day's news, because it's out there. While you and I may wish to take a little bit of a break, have a bit of a rest and relaxation over an annual holiday, remember, the grifters and the grafters and the thieves and the footpads and the cut purses of the Republican Party and the GOP and the conservatives and the teabaggers never take a day off. Never give us surcease from vigilance. And we have stories along those lines. And we'll get to them. But first this.
Happy Christmas, Calco.
Happy Christmas, Julie.
So this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. And a new one just begun. And so this is Christmas.
Thank you.
And for the official John Lennon estate sanctioned video, it closes, of course, with the remark quoting Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi, "An eye for an eye will make us all go blind." So here's it, you know, and that's an. Okay, come on, pick it up, Bob. We're out of Iraq. We have spent a fortune. We are still permanently based in Kuwait. And even as we sit here conversing, talking, whatnot, it is well worth remembering that there are people who have the ears of other people who are just positively itching to get a new one started. In particular, in Iran. I was reminded of this, that the Israeli defense minister, Ehud Barak, in response to questions of whether or not Barack Obama is cooperative with Israel, because, you know, the right wing says that all the time. He don't love Israel like he's supposed to love Israel. Ehud Barak said of the relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu, who is a piece of work, as we say around here, the relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama, Ehud Barak said, "They don't have to love each other. It's enough that they respect and understand that no one works as if they were alone in a bubble." And we should be very, very, we cannot drop our guard for an instant. Not even at this time of year. Because the blood talent hawks have left their Aries and are circling Iran. And there are people in this country who want war with Iran so badly, they can taste the metallic ferrous tang of the blood on their tongues. They want it. They pray for it. They ache for it. They yearn for it. They dream of it. Because, of course, they're not the ones who have to go and fight it. But they want it beyond any shadow of a doubt. And don't think for an instant that as 2012 approaches that they will relax in their demands. With an election year upon us, expect more, not less, saber-rattling. More, not less, shrill shrieking from the likes of the pro-Israel religion industry fundamentalists like John Hagee, or from AIPAC itself, screaming for mothers, sons, and daughters to be shipped off to die for the ambitions and the avarice of people far, far from the front lines, but who stand to gain tremendously in the sacrifice of the children of working people and poor people. It's just got to be remembered. By the way, we had some email in. I wanted to share with you. I told Jim he got a little fan mail last night. He got more fan mail this evening from our good friend Jerry out in Vegas, referring to Jim's, referring to Jim's comments last night, Jerry writes, Bob, I'm so impressed by Jim's bravery, his moral integrity, his human and humane honesty outweigh anything relating to religion. These qualities honor his spiritual quest. Jerry continues, to all the Horn family, be grateful for us all. Be grateful for Jim. Signed, Jerry in Vegas, the town that glows in the dark for more than one reason. And he closes, never stop, Bob. Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, and thank you, Jan. Jan just said, may your holiday weekend be a joyous time for all of you. We give thanks for you, Bob, and our Horn family. We've had the joy to share our mutual fears and hopes with one another, and to feel not alone is a glorious feeling. Bless you for working so hard for all of us. Jan notes, P.S., I love that song. Started my day. And that's how we feel. That's how we feel about each and every member of the Horn family. Bill in Helena, Montana, sending this along. Oh yeah, this is Christmassy, all right. I'm all over this. One of it wouldn't be Christmas without this. Some may prefer the Elvis version, but no, not I. Not I. Bill apparently has a solid handle on the way my strange little psyche operates, and sent along a little musical gift. And it'll be a nice, I think, nice counterpoint to the seriousness of the previous tune. As soon as it's done loading, that is. You have to deal with these things. We're still, you know, one of the things we're still looking toward going into the new year is expanding some bandwidth. It's just a challenge. It would be nice to have these things have them happen a little faster. But this is still, yeah, how can you not? Here we go. Let's back it up just a hair. Yeah. If this doesn't put a grin on your Christmas face, I don't know what will. Thanks, Bill.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll feel so blue. Just thinking about you. It'll be decorations of red on a green Christmas tree. It won't be the same there if you're not here with me. And when those blue snowflakes start falling, that's when those blue in memories start calling. You'll be doing all right with your Christmas right. But I'll have a blue Christmas. Baby, I'll miss you. You'll be doing all right with your Christmas. But I'll have a blue Christmas.
You know, it's the kazoo that makes that. There's nothing in this life quite like a kazoo solo, and golly Moses, that's just a restaurant quality example of kazoo virtuosity. Thanks, Bill in Montana for that. I may not be okay for a while. God, I love it. And by the way, for those of you who didn't hear it, one of Mike Malloy and Kathy's Christmas traditions came around again last night. The Oh Holy Nightmare, as Mike refers to it. I don't know how many times I've heard that thing, and it just ruins me every time. And it really is one of those call the family together to listen kind of things. I guess it was last year. God, I'm beginning to say, I actually looked into the sources of that, and it's fascinating. It's the story of how Oh Holy Nightmare got around is absolutely. It was done by a professional musician in Nashville as a lark to see how many messed up ways to perform a song could be worked into one piece. And apparently he thought nothing further of it, set it aside, and as often happens, I guess, in the recording business, the guy who had the tape began, made a copy and passed it to one of his engineer producer buddies who made a copy and passed it to the, and that's how it spread. Mercy. It's so special. Yeah, that's right, David. David in Tennessee. Oh, not just a kazoo, a hot kazoo solo. Bob. Jim with a note, my sincerest thanks and gratitude for the kind words coming from Jerry in Vegas. Indeed, indeed. Where Festivus declares an airing of grievances, perhaps we have the common good sense to see the season as an opportunity to, do a little healing. Do a little healing. I'm trying not to walk into the swamp. It's about 26 minutes before the hour. You know what? I got a light blinking here. Let's go to the phones instead. Instead of sending me to the swamp. It's too early for that. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, happy holidays to you and the Horn family and everybody else listening.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you very much.
Well, I just thought I'd give my take on the holiday season and maybe give some suggestions for a film or two that people would be interested in watching.
Wonderful.
Well, I guess for my first suggestion is, and Bob, you have to see it. Your family has to see it. Everybody listening, you got to see it. It's the new Martin Scorsese film, Hugo. It's amazing.
Is it really? I mean,
it is. It is, Bob. There are flaws in it. I will give people that. But here's the point. The point is that Martin Scorsese was able to summon back his original muse and translate it into a film, weaving history and fiction all together with a moral parable that we can all learn from. And it's an amazing trip, what he does with the special effects. And like I said, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but it revolves around clocks, an automaton, and a great cast. You got Ben Kingsley, you got Sacha Baron Cohen, and you got Christopher Lee. That right there should make a lot of people go, yeah, I'm going to watch.
Yeah, how do you not?
Right. And I mean, and everything about the movie, Sacha Baron Cohen has a great accent in it. A great English accent, a good character. The way Martin Scorsese has put together this film for the family is perfect. There really is nothing objectable to it. And the main thing about the film is that this is, to me, it's a lesson for our times. Because what he does is he goes back to post-World War I era, and he resurrects a time. And he shows you the magic of cinema without actually people involving, there's that much cinematic, influence in the movie. And what I mean by that is a lot of, they couldn't go to the theaters because they were poor, but he finds a way to weave that all together. So, this kid's imagination, what it's like going to the theaters, what it's like to have an adventure. And the children that play in the movie are just great. And it's, to me, people are going to look back on this Martin Scorsese film, and they're going to, well, what he's done is he's resurrected a time period of film that a lot of people probably never paid attention to except film students.
Wow, that's impressive, you know, because it's already in theaters?
Yeah, it's already in theaters. I will be sending a trailer for you, Bob.
Awesome.
But for everybody, I would take your family. If you can wait for the DVD. I am kicking myself because it is 3D, and I don't know. Maybe it's some bad 3D. I don't know. But the version I saw, I learned a lot about that particular time period, and I think if you go in without reading a synopsis and letting the story unfold, I think that's the best way for the family. Just tell them, like, this is a film involving children on an adventure, and it involves clocks and the nature of time and mortality and a sense of loss, and then the most important part, which is remembrance. It's never too late to exalt someone and give them their proper due. And like I said, Hugo is a lot of the critics, if you Google a lot of the people who are into Martin Scorsese, a lot of the people were surprised by it, and it's really a multi-layered type of a family.
Well, maybe that's the one film a year that the family goes to on Christmas Day. I don't know.
Well, you know, I try to avoid the Christmas family, the Christmas franchise movies, because so many times it's such BS.
Well, the last time we did it was freezing blooming cold, and we went to see the 3D version of Avatar.
Right, right.
So maybe, you know, with Monday being Ferg's birthday, maybe we'll take in an afternoon showing of that, and or an evening showing of Hugo, and celebrate that way. That's a great idea, David. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to mention is I mentioned this to you before, Bob, and it is upon us now. The new trailer for the Ridley Scott prequel to Alien: Prometheus is out.
No, really?
Yes. The movie drops. Put it on your calendars, ladies and gentlemen. The movie drops June 2012. When you see this trailer, I think I'm gonna put myself out on the line here. I think he's going to rewrite the whole Alien franchise of how he wanted it to be done. And I'm telling you, Bob, the space station, the way they put this trailer together, you get 2 minutes. You want to see the movie as soon as it's done.
Oh, wow.
Prometheus. And the other thing I wanted to mention was, in case people didn't know, I may have mentioned this on the horn, there also is going to be a follow-up Blade Runner movie after he does the Alien films.
Oh, wow.
So that's something to look forward to. So, yeah, I mean, if you search on YouTube and you type in Prometheus trailer, HD, you can see what everyone's talking about. I mean, in 30 seconds, you'll be enwrapped in the world, and it's like Ridley Scott never left. It's amazing, and a lot of people are gonna. I think a lot of people are gonna be surprised by how much in depth that he's gonna go into the story of Alien.
Oh, too cool. So I guess this is it's different from like the Star Trek prequel in that is it gonna be different characters, or is it a
I think what the movie is going to revolve around. I didn't read that much to it, because what they do, a lot of these film critics, what they do is they like telling the backstory and like going a bit too far because they have personal information.
Yeah, see, that's why I try to stay away from this stuff, because I don't want to go in knowing what's coming next.
Right, right, right. And but basically, as I understand it, this is about what went wrong with the species of alien, and I guess he has a term for it. He calls them space jockeys, and there's a whole bunch of a backstory to it. And again, this is a
well. I'm almost more intrigued, frankly, David, by your casual mention of a sequel to Blade Runner.
I think that's a teasing carrot that he's giving everybody else, and I think he's committed himself. I'm already surprised that the Prometheus film has done. Ridley Scott works like a, to me, he's one of the greatest of our times. I'm sure we can all agree with that in terms of film and cinema.
Oh, Blade Runner's on my top 10 list.
I'm glad it's not a film about Muslims and Christians or some battle scene like that. I mean, I was getting a little bit tired of that, so.
Well, it does get a little tiresome. I think they wore out the franchise in the 12th century, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of if he ever did it. Did he do another sci-fi film after Blade Runner and Alien? I'm trying to think, and I can't
think of one. And of course, the other thing that's out there, I've mentioned frequently the book that Reverbo got his signature line from, you know, Make It Personal.
Right.
Comes from a book by Richard K. Morgan called Altered Carbon. And in reading up on that, somebody's got, well, no, in fact, we talked about who has the film rights to it. And I'm still waiting for that to come out because you can't read that without, and even the author acknowledges what he owes to Blade Runner and Philip K. Dick out of, you know, in the creation of that one.
Right.
There are three books that he's written, all of which I guess have been optioned one way or the other, that when they come out will feel probably very much like sequels to Blade Runner. Let me ask you this, though, because you're such a genius at finding stuff, David.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this time of year, it seems like they haul out every Christmas movie ever made.
Right.
And what, Christmas Day, I'm sure there will be a couple of channels. One of them will be running 24/7 It's a Wonderful Life, and the other one will be running 24/7 Christmas Story.
And then 24/7 Lifetime Christmas movies that nobody has an interest in seeing.
Right, and then there'll be a 24/7 showing of Scrooged, which is but from the one, there's an old one. It's a black and white. It's from the 40s or whatever. There's an old one that I never see played anymore that I used to just absolutely adore because it was instead of being all entirely swept up in smarmy rank sentimentality, for which, I mean, you know, and I love it as much as anybody does, but sometimes you need a good giggle. And it starred, among others, I can't remember anybody else right off the bat, but the protagonist of the film was played by Barbara Stanwyck.
Mm.
And it was called Christmas in Connecticut.
In Connecticut.
Yeah, it's a lovely premise, and it's a funny premise because you've got a woman who writes. She's a nationally known, syndicated, perfect homemaker columnist. I guess in our era we would think of maybe a Martha Stewart. Okay.
Right.
And so the magazine thinks there would be nothing finer, and it's set, you know, it's the World War II era. There would be nothing finer than to send a young naval officer or whatever he is to her home in Connecticut, and she would make the perfect homemaker's Christmas feast and do Christmas to the nines and everything. And there's only one problem, and this sets up the whole thing, and that is that she is a complete BS artist who just writes this stuff that has no clue whatsoever what she couldn't roast a turkey. Couldn't sew two pieces of cloth together. She's a complete inept. Mm-hmm. And so as this thing comes together, it's that madcap stuff that was really there was a golden era of it, and it's a brilliant little film, and you never see it anymore.
Well, you know, I think that's interesting because there's a lot of films like that. They put, it's the same way, you know, what they do with music, where they take the same two Led Zeppelin songs and run them over and over again on every single classic rock.
But you never hear anything off of any of the other albums.
Right. I think that's the same type of premise, and I think it's, you know, focusing on the hottest commodities and getting all you can out of those particular products. And I really do think it is a bit of a game and a bit of a scam going on in terms of, you know, especially what they do with the, like the way they put films on the holidays. And then they just take the select few films that they have. And maybe it's because, maybe it's because they own a piece of the property.
And it's so deeply influenced by marketing, David. God, when did they show the Grinch? Was it a week after Thanksgiving?
right. Well, you know, my favorite Christmas Carol is the one with starring Ron Paul, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Now, see, I got to be careful because, you know, Jim made that reference last night to Ron Paul in the Bruno movie. Well, and then I'd forget, he really was in it.
Well, I mean, he wasn't in it. But, I mean, it was revolved around the same thing. He was watching over his money and his gold. And he wanted people to be more independent like him. And he wanted people to work till they die.
Yeah, and of course I have a copy in front of me in PDF form of the seminal Ron Paul holiday treatise, Abortion and Liberty, by Congressman Ron Paul.
I think this is the biggest problem with a lot of people who have written books that are out of print. They're not going to be out of print if you're going to run for a presidential candidate.
Well, you know, the address on this thing, in the frontispiece, or whatever we call it, is the Foundation for Rational Economics and Education of Lake Jackson, Texas. Now, you reckon this is the same outfit that pulled in the $1 million with all the ugly racial slurs that we mentioned last night?
Well, you know, Bob, I think...
Because it's 1983, it's roughly the same time period. It's contemporaneous, I think.
Yeah. I believe that there is a bigger story, that there are people here listening, that the Nation and New Republic and all of this. I believe the big story is that all the money going in, where does it go? Because it doesn't look like there's... I'm not saying Ron Paul is running a serious campaign, but they have to have that talk. You would think, Bob, they have to have that talk. Is this for their race war, or are they going to give it to their family members? Where is all this money going to go?
Yeah. And the beauty of this little tome, it has an introduction, of course. It, you know, no serious book can go without an introduction. And it has, and this is some real log rolling, David. It's beautiful. You know, things like the fresh insights that Ron Paul, the physician, brings to the question of abortion stem from the experience he developed as a member of Congress as he contemplated the relationship between natural rights and a free society. Now, if I was editing this, I would put, comma, without benefit of being the proud owner of a uterus. Okay?
Yeah.
But the best thing about that is when I scroll down, scrolly, read, and I come down to the line of who wrote this, 1983.
Right.
C. Everett Koop, M.D.
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, oh my God.
It's almost Dickensian, frankly.
I mean, all of these books, they should all be all brought to light. They should be in audiobook format, and Ron Paul should be reading them. I mean, because if you're going to be afraid of this stuff, you're not even in the ballpark for being considered as a leader.
I mean, I love some of the chapter titles. This is a real scintillating holiday classic, man.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Let's see, Rights of a Fetus, Mother versus Child, The Rape Issue, Psychiatric Justification, The Health of the Mother, Defective Infants. Just hearing those two words put together, they give me a sort of, well, it just gives me the creep, Defective Infants, Abortion and Child Abuse, The Viability Argument, The AMA and Abortion, A License is Needed. And then there's this chapter, which I just had to run to, My Views Changed. I formed my views on abortion while a medical resident before thinking through from a natural rights viewpoint. My sympathy for the inconvenience caused adults by the birth of unwanted children made me more tolerant of abortions. In one discussion with the chief of obstetrics, he told me that abortion should be done any time a pregnant woman wanted it or a serious defect was anticipated. I pointed out that diagnosing defects was much more accurate after birth than before, and he conceded quite consistently from his view that afterbirth decisions would be justified as well. Again, without any benefit of uterus ownership.
It is just a serious certified loony craziness.
And if you remember the death panels argument that Godzilla from Wasilla got started?
Yeah.
You know, those things don't just pop out into our cultural consciousness. They have roots. And in thumbing through this thing, I guess cybernetically speaking, I could sort of see in 1983 the thinking that would eventually lead to that barely literate woman babbling away with that with her varied forms of word salad, because Ron Paul argues at the end of this chapter, those who argue that abortion won't lead to infanticide and euthanasia are hiding from the facts. Dear God.
I'm starting to see a bigger picture on all the books and the literature and the setup of the branding and the campaign. And to me, it looks to me completely just like a whole con hustle game. He doesn't really care either which way what happens to the babies or whatever. He just knew that there was serious money in it.
Well, and he knew that he would never tap into it without getting on the right wing side of it.
Right, right, right. I mean, there's that photo, when I sent you that link to the Destructo blog, you see that photo with Ron Paul and Reagan sitting side by side. And to me, when someone says that their hero is Reagan, and you look into his background, I don't know,
I can't think along those lines without remembering that story from a couple of months back, David.
Yeah.
I forget who the young actress was, but the story of Ronnie Reagan bringing, and he was old enough to be her father, bringing her back to his seedy Hollywood apartment, feeding her a cold hamburger, and then stooping her and complaining about the cost of the condom. Just really, that just manifested everything you ever wanted to know about Republican conservatism, didn't it?
Do you think that could ever be a Hollywood movie scene directed by Clint Eastwood?
You're brutal. I was personally surprised that it somehow didn't make it into Saturday Night Live.
I did want to touch on I'm sure you've heard of the Fox News comment today, Brent Bozell.
Which?
Well, apparently Brent Bozell said on Fox News that they were talking about Newt Gingrich, and for some reason Chris Matthews was comparing him to, well, he's like a car bomber or something to that effect. And Brent Bozell said that this is the craziness of the right wing and how the dog whistling. He said, yeah, that would be like if we were just talking and I said, you know, Barack Obama is really as skinny as the ghetto crackhead. And then he says, by the way, he is.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, he said it right there. And the fact that...
And you're not safe from this. There's nowhere to go and hide from it.
No, and the fact that he said... And I was in a discussion with someone on the message board that I posted it, and they were like, yeah, but he was just saying that as a comparison. I said, no, you don't get it. He said, by the way, he is.
He is.
He was completely dog whistling. You know, he has his own foundation and stuff.
Oh, L. Brent Bozo?
Yeah.
No, that freak. He's been babbling around since the 80s. Does he need to go on the Sandra's glory list?
I think so. I think he needs to be on a lot of different lists, to be honest with you. What was it? The funny thing was Bob Seska actually posted a picture, and he said, well, if he's going to compare Obama to a crackhead, then how about this? And he showed a picture of Brent Bozell and then a picture of Dr. Zaius from Planet of the Apes.
Separated at birth? Anybody ever seen him in the same room?
Exactly. I mean, it's insane the fact that you have the Sensenbrenner and... actually going to the length of saying a ghetto crackhead instead of just saying, you know, Barack's pretty skinny. I mean, that's all you really have to say if you want to say he's a thin guy. And when you bring up the word crackhead and you actually say ghetto crackhead.
But doesn't that fall into a sort of natural progression, David, in light of the Sensenbrenner comment about the First Lady of the United States' posterior? Well, then you have to... it's like Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean. you know, you can't talk about Jack Spratt without mentioning his wife. So therefore, after the Sensenbrenner goes after Mrs. Obama, naturally another member of the disgusting right wing cabal has to go after the physical attributes of Mr. Obama.
I mean,
isn't it just sort of A then B?
I wouldn't be surprised if it is all completely coordinated in that sense.
Because even before that, of course, we had that sick right-wing bastard in California who referred to President Obama and, quote, his monkey children. So Basically that's the trifecta. They've done them all now.
Well, it's interesting the fact that it is nowhere to be, surprise, surprise, it's nowhere to be found on Drudge Report. But I guarantee if we called one of the Bush family members a crackhead, if one of the major progressive media foundation centers, someone from Media Matters or someone from that would be on the front page of Drudge with a blue siren.
No, it'd be like a strobe light. Oh, and by the way, in case anybody's curious, just to let people know, the film I mentioned a few minutes ago, Christmas in Connecticut, it has, for what was in that day, and the genre was the screwball comedy, it has a hell of a cast. It's Barbara Stanwyck, Dennis Morgan, and of course, every scene is stolen by Sidney Greenstreet. It's something.
Well, I'll definitely check that out. And before I go, because I want other people to get their shots in before the holidays.
Yeah, we want shots. We want people to get their shots in before Christmas. Come on, David, let's work the language a little bit, brother.
Okay, all right. I do want to mention that the film again is Hugo. It's directed by Martin Scorsese, and it's really such a great trip into the early days of magic of cinema and how it translates to a better quality of life.
Well, I'm sold. I'm definitely sold. Thank you, David, and a very Merry Christmas to you.
Well, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Scientology, Space Interstellar,
and Human Light Festival.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. You take
care,
David.
Bob, look in your mailbox after this.
Okay, will do.
All right, later.
Bye now. That's our pop culture correspondent, David from Maine, fulfilling his duties. Going the extra mile, and I would rather hear David from Maine talk about a film coming out and what it means than 99% of the professional reviewers that are brought on in any of the so-called professional for-profit media. Just by way of reference, you know, frequently we talk about the for-profit 1% media. And we do so by bringing in clips of the oxymoron Rush Limbaugh, or that little martinet Sean Hannity, or God knows the paranoid ravings of Glenn Beck. Here's a couple that I have never heard of before in my life, but they're being paid to put this filth out, and it's offered as some sort of quality entertainment. It is the the John and Ken Show. They're on Clear Channel radio station KFI out in California. Now here's what passes for right wing professional humor. Back on September 1st. They targeted an individual by the name of Jorge Mario Cabrera, who is a member of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, CHURLA. They targeted him by, of course, generally sleazing him, but they also gave out his personal cell phone number to their mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking audience. Cabrera told the Los Angeles Times that the calls were intended to diminish me as a person. And so consequently, bless their hearts, a number of groups have begun putting pressure on to boycott the John and Ken Show on Clear Channel KFI. and they're calling on the radio station to either get rid of John and Ken or deal with a boycott. Who advertises on the John and Ken show? Wow, what, Chevron? Hyundai? Target? And see, I see this as universally different from those right-wing freaks of the Florida Family Association who were horrified by the idea that Muslims in America who happen to be American citizens would somehow be portrayed as normal. Because we all know that they're just... they sit around plotting ways to make us all live under Sharia law. Fascinating, that Sharia law, insofar as it contains, you know, proscriptions against lending money at interest. Because that would be anti-American, wouldn't it? But they went after Lowe's, they went after Home Depot, they went after, not Home Depot, they went after a whole bunch of advertisers who knuckled under and pulled their ads because of scary Muslims. Now, it will be interesting to find out if KFI and Clear Channel will respond similarly, or in particular, Hyundai, Chevron, Target, if they will respond similarly, or if they'll say, well, you know, screw them people. We got people that loves the John and Ken show, and we're just going to keep on advertising with them because they're professional, that's professional broadcasters is what they are. Golly, Ned. 4 minutes past the hour, and we will come back with more phone calls. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, 304-658-3333, if you want to just direct dial and save us the cost of the phone call. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com. We'll be right back as we move through this pre-Christmas episode of The Horn.
Hello. You the new butler?
Well, it's been a long time since I've been the new anything.
What's happened to Hudson? I guess he's changing.
Yeah, he does that a lot, doesn't he? I'm David Bowie. I live down the road.
Oh.
Sir Percival lets me use his piano when he's not around. He's not around, is he?
I can honestly say I haven't seen him, but come on in.
Come in.
Come on in.
Are you related to Sir Percival?
Well, distantly, yeah.
Oh, you're not the poor relation from America,
right? Ah! Gee, news sure travels fast, doesn't it? I'm Bing.
Oh, I'm pleased to meet you. You're the one that sings, right?
Well, right or wrong, I sing either way.
Oh, well, I sing too.
Oh, good. What kind of singing?
Well, mostly the contemporary stuff. Do you like modern music?
Oh, I think it's marvelous. Some of it really fine. But tell me, you ever listen to any of the older fellas?
Oh, yeah, sure. I like John Lennon and the other one with Harry Nilsson.
Ooh, you go back that far, huh?
Oh, yeah, I'm not as young as I look.
None of us is these days.
In fact, I've got a 6-year-old son, and he really gets excited around the Christmas holiday thing.
You go in for any of the traditional things in the boy household Christmas time?
Oh, yeah, most of them, really. Presents, tree, decorations, agents sliding down the chimney.
What?
I was just seeing if you're paying attention. Actually, our family do most of the things that other families do. We sing the same songs.
Do you?
I even have a go at White Christmas.
You do, huh?
And this one. This is my son's favorite. Do you know this one?
Oh, I do indeed. It's a lovely thing.
To see pa-rum-pa-pum-pum. Our finest gifts we bring pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, rum-pa-pum-pum, rum-pa-pum-pum.
peace on earth can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see. See the day of glory.
See the day.
That piece just absolutely charming. Bing Crosby and David Bowie, Peace on Earth, Little Drummer Boy medley. And of course, when Bowie mentions, I'm assuming, I may be completely wrong, but when he mentions having a 6-year-old son, is that the son who has gone on to be one heck of a director now? Who did, what was it, The Moon or Moonbase? Brilliant film. And then the one that David from Maine talked about earlier this year, I can't remember the title of that one, but he'll send it to me post haste, I'm sure. So Merry Christmas, everybody. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
The movie Christmas in Connecticut, by the way, produced a little ditty by the name of White Christmas.
No, that's not Christmas in Connecticut.
I thought it was.
No, that's Holiday Inn.
Oh, yes, you're right. Sorry.
Yeah, Bing is nowhere near this madcap screwball comedy.
Yeah, I remember it, though. I loved it. Another in the same genre, although a little bit later in time, that I just adored, and you also never see it.
What's that?
It's called A Pocket Full of Miracles. Starred Glenn Ford.
Yes.
And Betty Davis.
Absolutely.
Very, very young Anne Margaret.
I'll be darned, I didn't remember that.
And it's an incredibly good movie, but you very, very rarely see it. I had to go out and buy this silly thing.
Well, and isn't there a John Wayne South Pacific setting movie, Finnegan's Reef or something like that? Doesn't that have a Christmas overtone? That was a fine little movie too. But they're out there. But what we're dealing with, Susan, is the fact that there's no real creativity in programming. They put the stuff out there that they think will tug the heartstrings and sell the commercials. Maybe I'm completely wrong, simply because my two dented tomato cans and a string cable system, I don't get Turner Classic Movies, and probably 99% of anything we would bring up in this conversation is running over there.
I've never seen it on Turner Classic Movies. Never.
And I guess it's because
I do get it.
Well, I guess it's because I'm a rank sentimentalist and a traditionalist of sorts.
So am I. I'll get, it's like that song, that John Lennon thing, I'm sitting, you start it, and I first four bars, and I'm dripping tears. because that song, you know, I came out of that era, and I heard, I remember the first time I heard that. And instant flashback to the 60s and the war being over and the whole nine yards. And, oh boy, oh my. And it's, that was part of what I was feeling when I saw that plane at McChord Air Force Base with all the soldiers coming on. And I have a question.
Okay.
I really do.
All right.
I don't really expect an answer, but I think it needs to be raised.
To wit?
Do you remember after the Warren quake, soldiers came home, got a big concert.
Yeah.
Big celebration. You know, they didn't, you know, the ones that didn't get a parade, you know, there was this big concert that was broadcast to every place, every place there was a U.S. soldier.
Yeah, are you noting the significant absence of that this time through?
Yeah, where is these guys' concert? Where is their celebration?
Then again, perhaps...
It has to be sent.
No, they didn't, but perhaps the celebration is in the survival. And that's a sad and sorry way to look at it, but it's not enough.
It's not enough.
But the other side of that coin, Susan, is that if something like that was to be done, now bear in mind, when a Bushy does it, it's done for purely patriotic reasons, even though no Republican gives a rat's rear end about the troops.
Yeah, tell me about it.
But if Barack Obama did it, if it was done during, no, not if Barack Obama did it, he's not a concert promoter, but if it were done during Barack Obama's presidency, and God knows during an election year, you would have nothing but 24-hour a day, 7-day a week, wall-to-wall, right-wing howling that,
oh yeah,
Barack Obama's exploiting the troops.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to say it. You can hear it. It's playing in your head right now, isn't it, Susan?
Oh yeah. But it's just wrong. It's just wrong. These guys, and let's face it, a lot of them came back in boxes.
If we dare recall some of the earliest days of George Bush's assault on the people of Iraq, remember, we weren't allowed to see them coming home, so the bodies coming home. So what we had secondhand things that sort of slipped into the media. I remember early in George's war, I remember the story that American soldiers' remains were being returned not in caskets, but in cardboard boxes, and that they were being offloaded with forklifts.
Yeah.
I remember that story brutally well, Susan. Do you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's like some of the crap that's going down now. With the Air Force, their little barrel scandal.
Oh yeah, dump them over there in the swamp, would you?
Yeah, and it's just, oh God, you know, and I'm going, oh my God, please, I'm
evil, just evil.
It is, and you know, it's just, where are these people's heads?
Well, it's not where their heads are, Susan. It's
their country.
It's where their hearts are.
What hearts? They haven't got any.
Precisely my point.
Yeah. As for upcoming movies, the one I want to see, and I realize that it's probably going to be a profound disappointment, but I got to see it anyway because of the books.
John Carter of Mars.
Yes.
I knew it. I knew you were going to say that because I'm the same way. I was trying to explain the John Carter phenomenon to someone a few days ago, I said, you know, it
you
was kind of...
explain it to me.
No, but to someone who's never read it or heard of it, John Carter of Mars is sort of the Hardy Boys of science fiction.
Exactly. Yeah, I know what Mars is like for real. But back then, we didn't. And so there was this entire world there, and this entire civilization.
Yeah.
And it was there. And it
Deja Thoris, and, right.
Yeah. And, you know, the Green Warriors.
and frankly, far more engaging than because Flash Gordon, of course, approached the same topic, but far more engaging, I thought, than Flash Gordon.
Oh, yeah. Flash Gordon was a bore, I thought. My only gripe with the Martian series was, let's face it, that poor woman.
That poor woman.
She went from one cliffhanger to another.
Yeah. Hey, John, you get in the soup this time. I'll rescue you.
It's your turn.
And just for anyone who would like to go and you know, it's wholesome, it's fun entertainment as reading goes, and they're all available for free.
Yeah, and you know,
in electronic format.
Yeah, even if you know, you know, sure, everybody knows what Mars is like, but they are enormously fun reads, especially the very, very first one, because.
Oh, the first, the setup is just amazing.
Yeah, the very, very first few of them are just amazing. The world building, the character building are just amazing. And you find how this guy came to be.
Well, Edgar Rice Burroughs was no slouch.
No, he was no hack. He was good. And he created this whole series, and it was just fantastic. And what was really cool was after a while you noticed, hey, wait a minute. This is starting to look like Earth because he had the red men, the yellow men, the white.
Well,
men.
and that's the thing. If you it was another instance of if you want to talk about this stuff, and we see it coming all the way up into the present day. Mike Judge couldn't talk about contemporary culture the way he wanted to without setting it 500 years in the future and calling it Idiocracy. The same goes for Edgar Rice Burroughs with the universe that he, and yeah, there's a lot of otherworldly stuff, but there's cultural commentary that is very, very real buried in that sort of thing. And to a young mind reading it, it's absolutely amazing.
Well, yeah, that's what Hyman did. You know, science fiction writers are not, quote, science fiction writers. They're social comment. They comment on the social condition, only they do it umpty-ump years in the future.
So that they can, comfortably, right, hide behind the futurism. I mentioned Richard K. Morgan talking with David from Maine. The three books that are set 1,000 years in the future are fascinating. They're a lot of fun to read. But the two that are set in the next 100 years are chilling.
Oh, yeah.
One of them is called Market Forces.
Oh!
And the other one, depending on where you are on the planet, here in America, we have to read it under the title 13. In the rest of the world, they read it under the title Black Man.
Yeah. Did you ever read a series of books, and I can't remember who wrote them, it was about, the main deal was they had a whole society that had these self-contained houses, and that were basically self-contained worlds.
No, that...
And the whole society was built around this company that was providing these houses. Basically, a case of corporatism run amok. The author, I'm going to have to look it up. He was a contemporary of Pornell.
Okay.
I'm going to have to look it up. Another one you need to look up is Kenneth Lee. She did another.
Oh, I remember. Yes.
Oh yeah. Where she's, this society is basically stuck under glass in the middle of a desert.
And there's, you know, there's a lot of that visionary stuff that looks an awful lot like the road that we seem to be traveling based upon concepts of climate change and change. And they may not even have been contemplating it, Susan, but it just informs their reality. You know, I recently went back and reread all the Dune novels, and kind of hard to avoid what was being contemplated there by Frank Herbert. And of course, he's held out now as the first science fiction environmental novelist. And
the thing with the John Carter novels, though, is I think Burroughs and the guy who wrote the Landsman series. Between those two, they came up with some of the best reading for kids. But the reason I called in, one of the reasons was David mentioned a Blade Runner.
Yeah.
I really want a Blade Runner written from the replicant's
point of view.
Yes, from the replicant's point of view. God, I want.
Well, see, in a way, if you get hold of Richard K. Morgan's Altered Carbon, Susan, you will find that.
Because
you know, everybody is to one degree or another replicated in that world, and it's really really superior stuff.
The one thing that has stuck with me of that whole movie is that one speech that the replicant.
Like Tears in Rain.
Dying.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Tears in the Rain.
Well, Rutger Hauer's finest moment.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there just weeping, you know, because of this creature. He's dying, and he knows it. And it's just amazing. And I'm going, oh, my God.
Yeah.
He's human.
Yeah, shameless name dropping here, a couple of years ago when I first got to meet Daryl Hannah, I was like, wow. What? And, of course, you know, you don't say stuff like that, but it was just running through my mind. You were in Blade Runner. Oh, my God. I'm not worthy.
I do have to ask the people. People, I just gave a present, Christmas present.
You did indeed.
And people, if I can do it, so can you. I don't have much of a family anymore, except the horn. So that's where I get my Christmas presents. And that's where I spend my Christmases. So maybe you should think about coughing up.
Bless your heart.
Because
I think you just captured it. This is family.
Yeah. And tell Agnes to take care of herself, huh?
Yeah, I will. You tell her too, but... And between us, we might as well be talking to trees, but yeah, we know that.
Yes, I know. I'm going to have somebody knock her down and sit on her.
Well, Susan, like every other member of the Horn family, you will be among those in our thoughts as we lift the toast of the feast come Sunday afternoon.
And give my love to everybody, and Marky, and Ferg, and Doodle.
I sure will.
And especially sis.
Absolutely. Will do.
Blessed be. And love to you, honey.
Thank you, Susan. We love
Bye
you bye. Dearly. Bye now.
Bye.
News Ninja Susan, calling from Oregon. I'll say honestly, I never had a clue when all of this got started. What it would wind up being, such a profound sense of connection to so many people. And if there is a magic of the season, that is certainly part of it. So I'm not, I'm not comfortable going on a rant or going on a tear. There are just realities that we face that perhaps we put aside this time of year. And just as we had a little giggle a couple of minutes ago, this is a brief little something that that our chat room moderator, the inimitable Lottie, who this Christmas will be celebrating by engaging in some traditional cooking. I think I saw in the chat room last night that he will be doing octopus again for Christmas. That's one of the frustrating things that we are so attenuated. I'd love to try octopus a la Lottie sometime, because he is a hell of a cook. The sweet potato pie recipe that has become traditional around here is Lottie's recipe. And, of course, in Italian families, octopus, yeah, absolutely. It's like a rib roast for folks of British extraction. But it's got to be yummy. In the Anthony Bourdain Christmas special, he went and watched octopus preparation by a dear friend of Christopher Walken's with Mr. Walken present. So that was... It just looks delicious. But Lottie sent this along, and let's have a giggle. Tom Lehrer.
Christmas time is here, by golly, disapproval would be folly. Deck the halls with hunks of holly, fill the cup and don't say when. Kill the turkeys, ducks, and chickens, mix the punch, drag out the dickens. Even though the prospect sickens, brother, here we go again. On Christmas Day, you can't get sore. Your fellow man you must adore. There's time to rob him all the more. The other 306, a T, a 4. Relations, sparing no expense, send some useless old utensil or a matching pen and pencil. Just the thing I need. How nice. It doesn't matter how sincere it is, nor how heartfelt the spirit. Sentiment will not endear it. What's important is the price. Hark, the Herald Tribune sings, advertising wondrous things. God rest ye merry merchants, may ye make the Yuletide pay. Angels we have heard on high tell us to go out and buy. So let the raucous sleigh bells jingle, hail our dear old friend Kris Kringle, driving his reindeer across the sky. Don't stand underneath when they fly by.
Sound advice in my book. Well, we're halfway through the program for the evening. The lines are open if you want to, stories, Christmas memories, everything's wide open here. But plus, you know, it's Friday. And consequently, it's Christmas Friday on the front porch. The front porch all garlanded with evergreen boughs and so forth, and pretty red bows. Or, you know, Friday on the front porch, right? So we can do that. We can do that as well. And just a couple of, a couple of news stories that are out there, banging around in the ether here 2 days before Christmas. It is worth noting that I don't know where you are, but it's not very Christmassy here. This might as well be the sort of drizzlesome early November rain that happens. But apparently it isn't just here in Appalachia. It's happening all over the country. And all over the world. You may recall an email coming from our buddy Scott in Sweden a month or so back, in which he noted how unseasonable the onset of cold weather had been there in Sweden. Well, our buddy Michael, who was in Norway, might also be able to verify what I'm reading here, that northern Norway in the month of November was 10 degrees warmer than average. That's 10 very important degrees. In Finland, snow has been replaced by rain. That wiped out World Cup and European Cup ski races. You know, you'd think you could count on having snow in Finland. It's all over the planet. The quote I'm looking at, referring to the footprint of global warming, notes, Helsinki is experiencing uncharacteristically mild December temperatures, and only light dustings of snow have come and gone. At the beginning of December, it was on average 6 degrees warmer than is usual for this time of year, meteorologist Pauli Jokinen told AFP, Agence France-Presse. He said the snow's no-show in the south of the country this year was partly due to natural variations, but also a footprint of global warming. You can't put a single season down to climate change, but we have seen that climate change has lifted the baseline temperatures. And ultimately, I guess we can have our disagreements about what that's going to mean, but when baseline temperatures rise, things will happen. And there's, you know, we're asked to believe a lot during this Christmas season by the likes of the American Family Association. Things that are, to a rational mind, physically impossible, that have never happened in human history and likely never will, absent scientific interference with the nature of human reproduction. And yet the right wing wants to turn their backs on real science that says, well, when temperatures go up, things melt, water levels rise, and as mentioned the other night on the program, teabaggers in Newport News, Virginia, and Hampton Roads, Virginia, say that it's all just a devilish communist plot to take them away from their beachfront property. It's a degree of fiddling. I don't know. It's fiddling while Rome burns with one of those little fiddles like Jethro Bodine had that had a hand crank instead of a bow, what these teabaggers and deniers and bought off by the oil industry people are doing. Last night, of course, we had the story of Rick Perry having his hissy at voters in Iowa for daring to suggest that fracking poisons water and, among other things, that climate change is real. But of course, climate change, I guess, is less real when your bank account has a lot of zeros. Oh, yes, absolutely. A suggestion coming in from, a request coming in from David in Tennessee. Ask Michael in Norway if he's had his fair share of glug this season. I heard a story on NPR about the traditional Norwegian holiday brew, and frankly it sounds kind of yummy. What is it, port and a burgundy and some orange peel and cinnamon and ginger and cardamom and various and stuff, and all warmed on the stove with sugar added, as was warned in the radio piece. You can get awfully fond of it awfully fast. 25 minutes before the hour, to the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Good evening, Jim. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. You know, it's real strange about these people who are worried about their beachfront property on Hampton Roads. I just wonder how they would feel if they should hear that the volcano at the Cumbre de Vieja has slid into the sea.
Yeah, because that beachfront property is going to go away in a real hurry if that happens.
I would think so. 300 meter tsunami. I think that would take care of a lot of their worries permanently.
Well, Jim, with something like that, you and I might very well have beachfront property by the time it was done.
Well, no doubt of that. No doubt of that. But, you know, as far as all these people whose only god is money and whose only religion is their way to rob their fellow man legally, illegally, any way they can. You know, hey, I hope you guys enjoy it, because one day you're going to pay for this.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar. It's not exactly, it's not a holiday film in the least, but you're familiar with Marathon Man, aren't you, Jim?
Oh, yeah.
You remember the climactic final scene down in the sewers when Laurence Olivier is compelled to eat his diamond?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that along the lines of what we're talking about here? That someday maybe you'd like for the light to go on for some of these folks and have them realize that they can't eat this stuff? I have yet to see a dollar bill successfully cooked into anything palatable, or even a hundred for that matter.
Nor have I. But, you know, these people, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm watching on Turner Classic, A Christmas Carol.
Which version?
These people, pardon me?
Which version?
Albert Finney and Sir Alec Guinness.
Yeah, that's magnificent.
It is, and it has some great songs and stuff like that. It means a great deal to me because I've seen it with some very good friends who aren't with us anymore. And it brings back a lot of memories to me, but as to so many past Christmases so many years ago that have been folded into the past. But as I think of these people whose only God is money, I just realize that they are Scrooges with no redemption. They're not going to be visited by any spirits except the ones that they engulf, whatever that might be. And they are forging for themselves chains upon chain upon chain upon chain, more than it could take any seven devils that Lucifer might put to work.
And more than anything that Jacob Marley walked around with.
Exactly.
Jacob Marley was a piker compared to, Charles and David Koch. How about them for a couple of potential future Marley nominees, Jim?
All these people who simply are out for the almighty dollar, who don't care about their fellow man, who don't care about the dissolution of the social contract, and who begrudge anybody who is hungry food by any means possible they can. And they do so not even as obliquely as they used to, but almost directly. And I don't see how these people live with themselves. I really don't. I think their conscience, if they ever had a conscience, is truly dead. And
when you exist in that kind of a state, Jim, isn't there a formal psychiatric and psychological diagnosis for that state?
Yeah, it's basically sociopathy.
Yes.
I mean, these sociopaths. I mean, I dare say that most of these people could pass any type of polygraph flying with no irregular lines drawn on the graph. And a lot of sociopaths can do that. And there are people without conscience, and there are people whose souls are dead. They never had souls. Or if they did, they killed them for the want of just a few years in which they could enjoy material gain. And I just wonder how much they really enjoy it. I just really wonder how much do they really enjoy it.
And, you know, that's kind of like me, Jim. I know people, especially in the Horn family, live in various degrees of want and need. And for me, the best definition of Christmas is, you know, the Christmas dinner means more than the Christmas packages. The time together means more than the stuff and the ripping off of the paper.
It's much more important. The people who are around the tree are so much more important than the presents under the tree.
Well, hear, hear. Absolutely.
And that's my message for this evening. They really are. And far as the other people to whom I've referenced previously in this phone con, they may know the price of everything, but the true value of nothing.
The value of nothing. Very well said, Jim. Very well said.
All my best to you and your family.
And to you as well. And to you as well, Jim. A happy and blessed Christmas to you.
Christmas Eve. That's it. Thank you, buddy.
Take care now. Bye. That's our buddy Jim with perhaps the evening's moment of profundity. It is not nearly as important what is under the tree as those who are around it. Hear, hear, Jim. Hear, hear.
Oh, Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter. Du grünst nicht nur zur Sommerzeit, nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter. Oh, Tannenbaum, du kannst mir sehr gefallen. Oh, Tannenbaum, du kannst mir sehr gefallen. Wie oft hat nicht zur Winterzeit eins weit von dir mich hoch erfreut. Oh, Tannenbaum, du kannst mir sehr gefallen. Sommerzeit, nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter.
Means Merry Christmas to you. Bon Natale to everyone. Happy New Year and lots of fun. Bon Natale, may all your wishes come true. Bon Natale in Italy means a Merry Christmas to you.
Far away across the sea, in sunny Italy, there's a quaint little town that a clock has been wound for over a century.
They don't know the time or year,
and no one seems to care.
And this is the reason the Christmas season is celebrated all year. Oh, Bon Natale, a Merry Christmas to you. Bon Natale to everyone. New Year and lots of fun. Bon life.
May all your wishes come true. On the time you Italy
means Merry Christmas to you.
Nat King Cole and Anthony Hamilton, Buon Natale, and before that, his rendition of O Tannenbaum. I like the Christmas songs in foreign languages. It's just, I am a hidebound traditionalist where this stuff is concerned, I guess. But lucky for you, you only have to put up with me doing it once a year. Ray writing in, by the way, and says, Jim gets a Hallmark toaster. Indeed. So it's about 13 minutes before the hour on this Friday, Christmas Eve. Jim had it right. And I'm off on a chase. Jim sent in a request for a particular Christmas tune that he doesn't have to hand and would very much like to hear. You know, this goes, in a way, this goes back to the very earliest stuff that I did when I was starting out in radio. And, you know, the playing of requests back in the day. Let me tell you, Sonny, once upon a time, there was no such thing as MP3. There were no iPods. We had records. And you put the tone arm with a needle on it, and that's how the record played. Oh, Jesus, let's not go there. But it is. It's kind of the essence of radio to do that sort of thing. I don't know. Let's see. Is it possible? Could it exist? Let's see. Well, lo and behold, Jim. Behold the coelacanth. I'll get this thing loaded up right away. You've got to try to honor a request, because, well, let's see, we've had Porky Pig singing Blue Christmas. We've had some Nat King Cole. Yeah. Jim is a master of the esoteric. And this is a wonderful example of that. And I think we will all probably enjoy this, once it's in hand. In the meantime, just a little reminder. You remember when the coal industry put out their singing lumps of coal that looked surprisingly like prehistoric coprolites, which maybe they are in the first place. Have I got the right word? Coprolite? I think I do. Well, Christmas is a chance to give back. And I know some of the people who did this, and I'm really, really proud of them for it. And just a moment to honor their determination and their courage, and yeah, their sense of humor. What I like to refer to as my brothers and sisters in the struggle against mountaintop removal down in Kentucky paid a visit to the governor's office back on the 19th, which would be Monday, was it? Something like that? Tuesday? I don't know. Monday. Come on, Bob. You've got a damn calendar here. Yeah, it was Monday. They paid a visit to the Kentucky governor's office in Frankfort, Kentucky. The governor is a guy by the name of Steve Beshear. Now, this is the guy, ostensibly a Democrat, who has, you know, done things like offered taxpayer funding for a fundamentalist religion industrial complex ARC park. No, really. Despite the fact that it's probably violative of the Constitution to use taxpayer dollars to advance a particular, and in this case particularly weird, view of the nature of life on this planet. But beyond that, Steve Beshear is also a huge fan, as I'm sure our buddy Corey in the Free State of Louisville, or our buddy Dennis down behind the cornbread curtain in the Commonwealth of Kentucky could attest. Steve Beshear is a huge fan of the ongoing poisoning and destruction of lives, families, and communities in Appalachia via mountaintop removal. Among other things, they have staged days-long sit-ins at the governor's office, and they refuse to be silent in the face of the abuses that the coal industry routinely doles out to the people of Kentucky and of Appalachia generally. So back on the 19th, Monday, as we now know, some folks decided to visit Steve Beshear's office again. Now, it's a real shame, but the governor wasn't there, and neither was the lieutenant governor. They were busy doing something else, probably doing shamefully embarrassing things to further endear themselves to the coal industry, for all I know. But public radio station WFPL reported, Governor Steve Beshear, let me get the radio voice on. Governor Steve Beshear got an early Christmas gift from anti-mountaintop removal activists today. Protesters spent several hours in the governor's office waiting for a chance to present him with lumps of coal. The protest was an extension of a weekly event that's been going on since February, but this time it had a holiday twist. Lexington teacher Martin Mudd dressed up as Santa Claus and says he's brought gifts for the governor. Santa brought the governor some lumps of coal and switches because he's been a naughty boy in not doing everything that he can to help protect the people of eastern Kentucky and our mountains and our water. Hear, hear. It takes some courage to do that, and it takes unwavering determination. Going back to 2009, you have to remember that, among other things, I guess Steve Beshear is like Kentucky's answer to Blanche Mansion. Beshear fired a guy named Ron Mills back in 2009 because Ron Mills, as in his capacity as the head of Kentucky's Mining Permit Division, had refused to issue a number of permits for Alliance Resource Partners. That's a company that's busy. They're out of Oklahoma. They never live where they make their messes, who are actively engaged in blasting the daylights out of portions of eastern Kentucky. And even though Mills refused to issue the permits, Beshear issued them himself. What's more, those executives from Alliance Partners of Tulsa, they actually lobbied the governor to fire the man. So yeah, I'd say Steve Beshear was entitled both to the switches and to the coal. Hey, if it's good enough for people who have to live underneath mountaintop removal sites, it ought to be good enough for Steve Beshear. So yeah, a little more Christmas music. This one by way of request from Jim.
Hört ihr Leute, pam pam pam, kommt alle her, geschwind, pam pam pam, zum neuen Königskind, pam pam pam, bringt ihm das Beste. Ram-pa-pa-pam, ram-pa-pa-pam, ram-pa-pa-pam. Lauf auch du zum Stall, ram-pa-pa-pam, kleiner Trommelmann. Lieber König, ram-pa-pa-pam, in kalte Winternacht, param, papapam, hab euch nichts mitgebracht, param, papapam, nicht Gold und Edelstein, param, papapam, ram, papapam, ram, papapam, nur mein Lied allein, param, papapam. spielte Baram Papam. Der kleine Trommelmann, Baram Papam. Das Christkind seinen Baram Papam. Und lachte ihm dann zu, Baram Papam, Ram Papam, Ram Papam. Spiel nur weiter du, Baram Papam, kleiner Trommelmann. Spiel nur weiter du, Baram Papam, kleiner Trommelmann.
How many, come on, be honest. How many of you even knew there was a Marlene Dietrich version of Little Drummer Boy in German? I mean, I didn't. That's a little gift in its own right. That gets added to the Kincaid Holiday Family playlist. That's mighty special. Thank you. Thank you, Jim, for turning us on to that. And since we're working the international side of the street, Lottie, with a note, says, "This Christmas carol is probably my all-time favorite. Yes, it's religious, and there are versions of it sung by Pavarotti and Bocelli, but the way I remember it, it is sung by the children's choir at the school Christmas pageant." Wow, does that take me back a few years? And the nice thing about this season is that you get to shamelessly time travel to simpler, arguably better times, and sweeter times, Lottie notes. As Mike Malloy would say, watch out, as this plays, watch out for a sugar rush. Tu scendi dalle stelle. I'm butchering that, I am quite sure. Tu scendi dalle stelle. Sung by a children's choir.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we've done the German, we've done the Italian, we've done English. Anybody want to dredge up a quality copy of En Flambeau Jeannette Isabella? Just saying. Maybe we can just make this all terribly international this evening. We've never done that before. Let's see, what else? I don't know. I don't think I'm ready to go syrupy yet. This is the Christmas Eve edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. If you were hoping to hear ranting and raving, I'm sorry if I'm disappointing, but I'm trying really, really hard not to do that. Although, folks, I don't know, maybe I should. Apparently, I'm not the only one, and by no means the only one, who casts memory back over the years at this time of year. Even Adam Gopnik at The New Yorker has done so. What Christmas meant, he writes. Christmas is 2 days away, and our thoughts turn. Well, our thoughts turn to the Jets and Giants, most likely, and to the confrontation Saturday between the happily married Eli Manning with the reputedly supermodel distracted Mark Sanchez. The rest of our thoughts, though, turn restlessly toward the day after, toward Christmas and its unsettled meanings. What does the holiday exactly mean these days? What has it ever meant? This is the kind of thing that makes the New Yorker subscription worthwhile, if I had one. Bill O'Reilly knows, or thinks he does, a sacred holiday hated by secularists and betrayed, sort of, by materialists. Others among the more proudly atheistic, new or old, take a grimmer view of it, hating its enforced, coercive happiness. See, I take a different tack from that. As the article on the Human Light Festival that Reverbo set along noted, it is almost hardwired into human DNA to somehow segment and mark the passage of time by things other than calendars and clocks. Long before there were calendars, clocks, or so much as a sundial, before ever the first chisel had been laid, the first stone chisel had been laid to the first hunk of stone that would become Stonehenge, long before concentric circles were drawn on rocks where the rising solstice sun would strike them, long before any native edifices were raised in such a way as to point to specific corners of the sky that would denote these seasons, humanity became aware of them. You know, the same humanity that, for instance, went deep into that cave in the Werner Herzog film that David from Maine put us onto, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. We have a hunger, and it's part of the general hunger, I think, to understand why we're here, how we're here. The very essence of existential questing. So, no, though I be agnostic or free-thinking or whatever it is I would be labeled as, I take no grim view of this time of the year. You know, I was thinking about it the other day that I have so often said, jokingly, that I can't wait for Canada to annex the Turks and Caicos Islands so I can move to Canada by going to the Caribbean. But the fact of the matter is, the one time I did so, as a result of the profound kindness of an individual who, to this day, insists upon remaining nameless, a mere couple of hours in the Caribbean sun, even with a hat, made me resemble something like Christopher Pike from the first Star Trek episode. And there's our Eat Christmas Eve Eve Star Trek reference for you, by the way. I was burnt to a frazzle and remained that way for the rest of the week. Recognizing that my forebears, going back thousands of years, were in Scotland and Ireland, and before that had come from Scandinavia, I've begun to wonder if maybe that's where I belong. Because I used to love the cold weather. I think it's only in the crankiness of growing up and paying power bills and things like that that I've come to loathe it. But there's a joy in being bundled up and dressed appropriately to deal with the elements, whether that is constituted by wearing fur hides and buffalo blankets, or by the latest high-tech gear from anybody from the North Face to Columbia to one of my particular favorite companies, Patagonia, whose clothing I cannot afford. Patagonia is one of my favorites because, among other things, they walk the walk and talk the talk. They are dedicated year in and year out to supporting efforts to make a better, more humane and less brutally oppressive planet. They have been supportive, among other things, of the work of Cold River Mountain Watch, which always earns my respect. But I like that kind of stuff. And I found, and in this weird-ass, rainy run-up to Christmas 2011 that has been just damp and squishy and yuck, I found myself saying, you know, maybe some snow would be nice. And then wondering what the hell had happened to my poor mind to make me say something like that. But say it I have. So maybe somewhere along the way, I do need to experience something in the way of a little bit more wintry circumstance. Because oddly enough, if you look at the history, human history, and I will of course defer to our expert in this matter, our good friend Dr. John in New York, the cultures that come from colder climes seem to work a little harder at getting along with each other. Or so it seems, at least on surface examination by yours truly. Maybe I'd better stop playing the Jimmy Buffett for a while. But having said all that, I say it because I do. I enjoy this time of year. I get positively giddy at the solstice when I know that there's going to be a little more light, a little more light, a little more light, and then, you know, it'll be time to think about the garden that I won't be able to put in. But anyway, Adam Gopnik at the New Yorker says, one thing for sure, Christmas as we understand it, Santa and the tree and the gifts and the department stores and even the Christmas Carol as a distinct form, what might technically be called the whole Megillah, is a modern invention dating back to the long Victorian years, the 1840s to 70s, and saturated with the whole of the era's fragrant, intoxicating ambiguities. Just a year ago, I spent week after week, the whole holiday actually, reading Victorian Christmas literature in a cubicle. No, call it a cubbyhole, more Victorianly. In the blessed precincts of the New York Public Library, an institution in need of no change. I dipped deep into what the ones who thought up the modern Christmas, the secularized materialist feast, thought they were about. I was researching a series of lectures on the modern meanings of winter, which I gave in Canada, though they remain quite invisible and inaudible in America. There was Dickens to reread, of course, and the great Chaz Boz, so much among us, in this 200th anniversary of his birth, and his Christmas Carol, which it turns out tells a more complicated story than we know. There was the meta story to learn of how Dickens took it up both as a commercial enterprise, self-publishing the story, and as a reformist tract. And the odd story to absorb of how it was the English reformers of John Stuart Mill's school who, at first, looked at it dubiously. Is just giving away Turkey's really good political economy? While the great reactionary Thomas Carlyle embraced it because he loved the total makeover it proposed for the Victorian heart. For Carlyle, as for Dickens, the concepts of reformist liberalism, the gradual, the incremental, the evolutionary, seemed inadequate to cure what was wrong with Scrooge. He needs an epiphany, not a reform bill. And Carlyle found an epiphany in it. Jane Welsh Carlyle, his formidable wife, wrote that upon finishing A Christmas Carol, her husband, quote, was seized with a perfect convulsion of hospitality and actually insisted on improvising two dinner parties with only a day in between, unquote. Then one learned how violently and quickly Carlyle rejected Dickens and his idea of Christmas after Carlyle realized that Dickens really meant it all. Dickens, Carlyle wrote in alarm, quote, thought that men ought to be buttered up and the world made soft and accommodating for them, and all sorts of fellows have turkey for their Christmas dinner. Commanding and controlling and punishing them, he would give up without any misgivings in order to coax and soothe and delude them into doing right. Close quote. Shocked though he was right. Dickens did think it made more moral and political sense to coax and soothe than to command and control. Men buttered up were men made better. It's at the heart of his view of the world and of Christmas. A lot of fun, too, he says, to see how the great rival among Victorian novelists, Anthony Trollope, was forced by commercial demand to write his own Christmas stories, and so use them to not too subtly mock Dickens, Mr. Popular Sentiment, as he calls him in The Warden. In one of Trollope's Christmas stories, a woman in Paris, in a hotel on Christmas Eve, is suddenly seized with the Dickensian Christmas spirit and goes, all by herself in the middle of the night, to the hotel kitchen to make a soothing mustard plaster for her husband's sore throat, only to enter the room of an unmarried gentleman and mistakenly and scandalously mustard plaster him. Don't trust mushy altruistic impulses on Christmas Eve, is Trollope's lesson. They lead to embarrassment more often than epiphany. And all of this comes, and it's a lengthy article, and well worth it, especially if you enjoy history as much as I do, and we all do. What Christmas Meant by Adam Gopnik at The New Yorker, dated today. But if you look at Dickens, not just from the coats as opposed to cattle prod aspect, if you look at Dickens. And good God, taken in context with the rest of the England of that era that he describes, it really was. It was the living definition of a life led nasty, brutish, and short. And he wanted it otherwise. And so you do get rank sentimentalism. And you do get a holiday that is made popular largely by virtue of the ability to market it and commercialize it. But down underneath it all lies the kernel and core of the moment. And that is, of course, that all too human desire to understand time and our place in it, and when the world will change, and when the sun will come back. Because you see, we still carry the same genotype, we still carry the same chromosome pairs as those people who walked into that cave in France 32,000 years ago, seeking to muster and master the power over the beasts of the world with which they lived beasts far more powerful than they would ever be. We would not speak their language if they spoke. Frankly, we would probably be all too willing to either put them in a zoo, dissect them, or just shoot them down where they stood, because we're very good at doing that to those with whom we are contemporary. But within the context of this season, and the rebirth of the sun, and the acknowledgement of a few more 100,000 miles traveled on this pale blue dot, this little time machine hurtling through the universe, it's okay if we get a little sugar rushy. It's okay if we linger another moment over the goggle-eyed excitement of a child at all the lights and the sounds of the season. And you don't need any particular religious dogma to do it. You can do it out of hand as a free thinker, an atheist, an agnostic. You can do it as a Wiccan, recognizing what this time of year meant in those ancient European traditions. Or as an animist, moved by those concentric whorls on a stone wall and the stabbing ray of light that moves through it every year, or the shadow that crawls down the back of the feathered serpent at the pyramid of Kukulcan in Chichen Itza. And it's okay. And maybe, like Tim mentioned, you'll just get misty-eyed thinking of loved ones drinking white wine in the sun. An email coming in from our buddy Jay in Yuma. Bob, you would have felt right at home in the lower Colorado River Valley today. The thermometer barely reached 64 degrees. Brr. Attached a snapshot of my family and one of me. Oh. Nice. A puppy. I love getting photographs here so that we can attach... so that we can attach faces to the ideas and the hopes and dreams and sometimes the outrage, occasionally the fear, and most happily the joy of the ideas that come in here. Thank you very, very much, Jay. Thank you. So, and this. Oh, Jim, I'm glad you like the Marlena Dietrich. Oh, okay. It wouldn't, we will admit some snark to the proceedings this evening. This coming in from Ray under the subject line, who, me? I bet Tim Tebow thinks Sunday's his birthday. and Kim's kind of on board too. She says, okay, Bob, I admit I like listening to some Christmas songs, even though I do not entertain any Christian beliefs, but I grew up listening to many of these songs and they do not bring back old memories. And suggests a song. We'll see if we can work it in along the way. Jingle Bells Australian Style from Robert, Phase 5. Let's check this out since we are working the international angles. Here we go.
Dashing through the bush in a rusty olden ute, kicking up the dust, Esty in the boot, Kelpie by my side, singing
singing Christmas songs. It's summertime and I am in a singlet, shorts and thongs. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Christmas in Australia on a scorching summer's day. Jingle bells, jingle bells, Christmas time is here. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a rusty old and new. Clones aboard, he is welcome too. All the family is there, sitting by the pool. Christmas Day, the Aussie way, by the barbecue. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Christmas in Australia on a scorching summer's day. Jingle bells, jingle bells, Christmas time is new. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a rusty olden ute. And Uncle Bruce are swimming in their clothes. The time comes round to go. We take a family snap, then pack the car and all shoot through before the washing up. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Christmas in Australia on a scorching summer's day. Jingle bells, jingle bells, Christmas time is here. Oh, what fun it is to ride in the rusty old and new.
This program gets a little bit more cosmopolitan and international with every passing program. And Ray writing in, by the way, says, oh, I get it now. You're a sentimental agnostic humanist. That's it! You have to let the sentiment run free once in a while just to keep from, oh, I don't know, turning green and getting all grinchy, I guess. And besides, our little dog would not look at all good with antlers strapped to its head. And I don't know where in the heck Mount Crumpet is. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Preston.
Well, hey, Preston. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Likewise. Definitely. Well, since it's Christmas time and gift-giving time and all that fun stuff, as I was listening to your earlier conversations, I was kind of poking around Wikipedia. And I discovered something called free cycling.
Yes.
Okay. And apparently it's a group that organizes or coordinates local groups or individuals to either offer or receive free stuff, you know, something that somebody doesn't need anymore.
Yeah, it's a wonderful organization. I remember John Fox talking about it some time back, and there are little enclaves of free cycle all over the place.
Oh, great. Great. Well, so, anyway, if people have some gifts to give or are looking for something, I guess they give out things like, everything from hardware to lawnmowers or whatever. I don't know. Have you used it yourself?
I have not personally used it, but I have heard accounts of its successful use.
Okay.
It works.
Great, great. Anyway, what else? What are you up to?
Well, we're just kind of mostly getting ready for the holidays, and like I said, my big focus is the holiday feast. So, yes. I'm trying to pull together all of that. Since we began this call, the three little kids who started out reading have since turned into three teenagers, and they've all entered this very little cramped studio, so...
We'll man.
Stop it, Ferg. I suppose in nicer circles, Preston, we would say he is irrepressible.
I was really enjoying your earlier discussion, I think it was with Juanita, about literature and stuff. Was it Juanita?
No, that was Susan.
Susan, I'm sorry. Great. So they're all readers.
Oh, that's one of the beautiful things about the, you know, that we've learned over the course of all of this, and that is that this is a very, very, very literate audience, and I don't think I could make it otherwise.
Great. You know, I've been getting into a lot of audiobooks recently. I got something from the library. Speaking of free cycling.
Yeah, no kidding.
The Denver Public Library. I got an audiobook called Alternidad by someone named Neil Pollack. And I don't share all that he's saying, but it's a really humane story of his experience at fatherhood. And anyway, a lot of good audiobooks floating around out there. Low Impact Man, I don't know if you've seen that documentary, but there's a audiobook that goes with that.
Oh, I'll check that out. That sounds interesting.
Okay. Colin Devin, I think. Anyway, what else? Oh, and speaking of consumption issues, today on NPR I heard Annie Leonard. I'm sure you're familiar with...
Yeah, the story of stuff and now the story of capitalism. Or no, the story of broke.
Yes.
Yeah, and that is brilliant. Well, they both are. But the story, I never saw the story of broke coming, and then when it hit, it was like, well of course, there's no way she could have avoided it. And it's the same gentle teaching style, and it should be viewed by every single human being in America, even if the teabaggers would then, like, you know, scream and scratch themselves, Preston, they should still see it.
It's really circulating around out there. It's good to see. You know, Glenn Beck was doing, trying to do a hit pieces on her, trying to give her the same kind of treatment as he gave Van Jones. So,
has he tried to paint her as a communist 9/11 conspiracist, hater of white people?
Something along those lines.
You really know you've made it when the Beckerheads come after.
That's true. That's true.
And by the way, a little affirmation coming for you, Preston. Kim just wrote in and said, Ray and I give things from our house away all the time on freecycle.net. It's in most cities. The only rule is this. Everything you post and give must be free. It's a great way to reuse what is useless in your home with others.
Excellent. Great. Great. Yeah, I guess it's part of this movement of many groups like that, part of a field called collaborative consumption. Is what they're calling it.
Oh, that's it. That's nice. I didn't know there was a word for it.
Nor did I. Wikipedia is a great thing, and that's kind of a collaborative effort too. I mean, it's interesting.
Well, the whole open source concept is fascinating, and I guess that is the ultimate expression of what cybernetic collaboration.
Yeah. And it's good to see. You know, again, we see these concentrated media places that can be so, degrading and manipulative. The Fox News and, so much. I think a lot of the action-adventure genre of movies is very, militaristic and jingoistic. But anyway, there's these entirely different discussions going on through social media and just like something like YouTube. I find myself sometimes kind of taking a technology like that for granted, I guess, or maybe.
Well, I don't beat yourself up, Preston, because I think that the whole goal of it is to become absolutely ubiquitous in our world so that we cannot imagine a time when, fill in the blank, just like me being a little bit of a smart aleck about vinyl records and needles and tone arms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I saw an article a week or so ago, I can't remember who sent it to me, but it was 11 sounds your children have probably never heard. And, of course, one of them high on the list was the sound of a rotary phone dial dialing the number and then cycling back.
Right. Not unless someone has it as their ringtone. That's kind of a,
My ringtone is an old school phone ringing thing.
Right.
Because for the longest time, all the ringtones were some song or some MP3, But I've noticed that more and more people have reverted to that ringtone, Preston, and I think it's actually a cultural phenomenon.
It is. It's funny.
I want my phone to sound like a phone. I don't want my phone to sound like Lil Wayne.
Right.
Or, for that matter, Toby Keith. I mean, I don't want to be perceived as singling anybody out, but I want my phone to sound like a phone.
No, definitely. But, but back to YouTube real quickly. I mean, what a tool that is in front of us. What got me thinking about these communication issues recently, I heard a guy named Jeremy Rifkin. I don't know if
yes.
you know his books at all.
Yes.
Like 20 years ago, I read a book by him called Entropy, and it's about energy and stuff. He's done other books on time, the concept of time, and all kinds of stuff. But most recently, he's got this book called The Third Industrial Revolution, and he talks about how technologies are moving less kind of hierarchically, top-down, or pyramidical fashion. It's moving side to side. And he uses social network communication as an example, and also distributed energy, like solar on people's rooftops and stuff like that, geothermal.
Yeah, the stuff of that future that our good buddy Albert in Southwest Wisconsin so often talks about. You know, when he says, "I see no reason not to be able to look out my window and see solar panels on every roof contributing to the overall power grid of my neighborhood."
Yep. Yep, for sure.
But you know, you mentioned the power of something like YouTube, and then there are the live manifestations like Ustream and Livestream, and Livestream's been so integral to the spreading of the message of the Occupy movement, for instance. Yeah. I guess some of my colleagues probably get tired of me. I'm getting to be a little bit like Cato the Elder or something, who stood up, you know, every time, "Good morning, Cato," and Carthage has got to be destroyed. That's all he ever said. And I'm a little bit like that among my colleagues because, "Good morning, Bob. You know what? We need to be our own media."
Yeah.
And I'm a broken record that way, but I'm going to keep on doing it until people, because, you know, there's stuff out there, Preston, understanding, you know, we who want a better world and a better planet, and you just can't say that about conservatives, right wingers, teabaggers and the like. They don't. They want the old planet back. They want to live in Leave It to Beaver world or whatever, or Father Knows Best, you know, the ultimate manifestation of mid-century paternalism. And what we who want a better world are never going to have $50 million for a complete CNN buyout campaign like the coal industry does.
Yeah, but, you know, groups like Audubon, the Sierra Club, you know, a lot of them really need to be putting, you know, some capital, some of the money we do have.
Yes, they do. I'm glad.
It's our money. We're the members. You know?
I am so pleased that you said that. And frankly, you, Preston, do not hesitate to let the organizations know, and you do so respectfully and peaceably. I'm so glad you mentioned that because, frankly, Michael Bloomberg gave that $50 million to the Sierra Club for the so-called Beyond Coal campaign.
Okay.
This is one of those that's been under my skin like crazy. Michael Bloomberg gave $50 million to the Sierra Club to use to transition away from coal-fired power plants, which in itself is a laudable goal, and don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But the
nuclear, or
well, there's that question. But secondarily, there's the additional problem, and it's personal to me, and perhaps personal to folks in the Powder River Basin, or our good friend Jeff Biggers down there in Little Egypt in southern Illinois, or the Diné people of the Black Mesa in Arizona,
or the people of Colombia.
The bingo, yes, exactly. Or the folks, or the indigenous peoples who still live by the salmon cycle in the rivers of Alaska, that just happen to have brown carboniferous mud under them. And the problem is this: if we shut down every coal-fired power plant in the United States, it will not stop what is being done to all those various peoples that I just mentioned, Preston. It won't stop it.
Yeah, and all that carbon is still going to be in the process of gathering and collecting in this, you know, double glazing of the earth that we've done with CO2. That's going to continue.
Right, exactly, because all of that coal, it's kind of like the that big honking lie that Rick Perry told about the Keystone XL pipeline. If it goes to Texas, we're going to pay less for gas. You know, that's the biggest, well, one of the biggest lies that's ever been told in human history, I think.
Yeah, and what's the accounting process here? I mean, we'll pay less for gas, right?
Right, that, and that certainly doesn't take into account the externalized factors that must be ultimately taken into account.
That magic trick they do, oh, that's an externality, that we're going to take out a forest the size of Florida to get to this tar sands.
Exactly. And so all of these things, stopping coal-fired power is not going to stop coal from being blasted and ripped out of the ground because of the international market for it. You know, the only thing that will work to save these peoples who are under assault is straight-up abolition, just as was the case with slavery.
You know, the abolition and also the, you know, drawing out the alternatives, you know, both a better future in terms of, you know, distributed solar power and geothermal and all that and efficiency. That's the lowest hanging fruit, just being more efficient.
And they hate that, so too.
They do.
Yeah. I mean, this business, this congressional business of the assault on the light bulbs, it blew my mind when I realized that we actually have an American compact fluorescent bulb industry, and it's growing, which means, of course, jobs. So naturally, the Republican House of Representatives has mounted a full-scale assault to try to kill that industry and kill those jobs in favor of people being able to continue to screw incandescent light bulbs into their sockets.
Yeah. You know, there's some very interesting battles going on, you know, within commerce, you know, between corporations at times, between PR agencies like the, you know, coal versus clean coal PR people versus the wind power PR people. And there's espionage and all kinds of financial tricks going on. And you know, Monsanto and Cargill, they don't want distributed, you know, wealth and entrepreneurship regarding agribusiness or agriculture. So they've got their interests, but, you know, we've got 5,000 farmers markets now, and that kind of cottage industry is getting...
Well, and yeah, the poisoners and the fossil fuel people, yeah. I think in their darkest moments, they sort of have to look at their world and realize that they are standing at the sea, commanding the tide not to come in.
Yeah, yeah. And some have. Some are doing that. You know, Ray Anderson, what a great story of kind of radical change within industry. The guy was a CEO of, like, the third largest carpet and tile company in the world. And he said he read one of Paul Hawkins' books, I think The Ecology of Commerce. And he had a revelation and realized what a plunderer of the earth he's been. And, you know, they had a lot of work to do, and it was really sad to see him pass away this past year. But his legacy will certainly live on. And
because his words do.
Yeah, yeah.
Indeed.
His books and all that good stuff. But.
Well, Preston, I hate to say it, but I do need to roll on because we are going to try to keep up with this one little tradition we have here for the holidays, and that is the readings of Matthew and Luke as performed by the Kincaid teenagers.
Oh, wonderful! Right on. Look forward to hearing that. For
but
sure.
I'm really glad you called in, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday over the weekend and a very happy new year if we don't talk before then.
Likewise, and to everybody in the Horn family, Merry Christmas.
All right, thank you, Preston.
Bye bye.
Bye now. Calling from Denver, that's the Horn's resident optimist. That is Preston. So we have reached that time. It's 17 before the hour. I don't imagine it will take that much time to do the reading, but I wanted to afford plenty of time in which to get it accomplished. I'm fond of the King James Version, not for any particular truth with which it is freighted, but for the same reason that I'm fond of the plays of William Shakespeare. It was a usage of the English language that was expressive and beautiful. One little note before we begin. If you think back in the program earlier to when we played that Bing Crosby, David Bowie medley, in there is a line about peace on earth, and Bowie sings it, peace on earth to men of goodwill. Now you will hear in the reading from the book of Luke, the line from the angel, peace on earth, the heavenly host, glory to God in the highest, peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Which is one of the reasons that the Bible has such fundamental problems, and that is, it has been messed up immensely over the... Well, and we don't even know what the original texts said, because we don't even have them. But the fact of the matter is, what we do know from textual criticism is that that's not what it says in the Christmas story. It does not say, glory to God in the highest, peace on earth, goodwill toward men. It says, peace on earth to men of good will. Because, you know, if you're rotten, what peace on earth do you deserve? So, just that little reminder as we begin now. You will hear some creaky microphone boom noises. Yeah, just like that. He's his old man's son. He does on the fly sound effects. So we will begin with the voices you will hear are Ferg, then Margie, and then Doodle. And these are readings that come from the book of Matthew and the book of Luke of the New Testament, commonly referred to as the Christmas story. Sorry about that sneeze.
Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. When as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is the Holy Ghost. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. Then Joseph, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord had bidden him, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Jesus. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go and search diligently for the young child, and when ye have found him, bring me word again, that I may come to worship him also. When they heard the king had departed, and lo, the star, which they saw in the east, went before them till it came to, and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gold and frankincense and myrrh.
And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out to the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that, while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you, ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger.
And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, God will goodwill toward men. And it came to pass that the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which is come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in the manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told to them concerning this child. And they all that heard it wondered at those things which were told to them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, as it was told unto them.
Thanks, guys. That was a somewhat modified order. That was Margie, then Ferg, and the last you heard was the youngest, Doodle. So basically what we did is we went in order of age, for Margie is the eldest. And and you know, this has been an especially touching and sentimental year, because in the new year, Margie will turn 18, and there's every likelihood in the world that by this time next year, she'll be off in college somewhere. So it remains to be seen whether there will be another one of these, or whether it will just be a duet between Ferg and Hootie. But truthfully, thank you. Thank you. For all that you, not I, all that you make the horn to be. It is difficult to express. And I hope you understand that, though difficult to express in its fullness, that fullness lives in our hearts. So I hope you all, however you celebrate it, and for whatever reason, regardless of whatever religious tradition or lack thereof informs your celebration, we here all hope that you have a very, very happy one. Just a little program reminder. We will not be on the air Monday. Monday is another holiday, as previously noted in many parts of the English influenced world. This is the day after Christmas is Boxing Day. We know it around here as Ferg's birthday.
What?
Who will be 16, and has persistently reminded me of the fact since the day he turned 15.
Yeah.
The day after he turned 15, he started saying, "I'm almost 16." Let's put it that way.
It's the dating age.
Stop it. So that's where we'll be Monday. And then back at it on Tuesday, and we'll be here all week long Tuesday, barring any intertube weirdnesses. So again, a very happy holiday to you all. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. A joyous Kwanzaa. Happy human light celebration. All of those things. Or none. But nothing but happiness is our wish to you all. So we will take out of here and catch you on Tuesday. Of course, our ongoing thanks go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch. Go there, crmw.net, where you can learn about all the heroic and magnificent work that Coal River Mountain Watch does. And you can sign up and become a member by joining the email list. You can order a really cool t-shirt and perhaps even contribute financially to the efforts to bring an end to the horrors that are mountaintop removal, that seem particularly pressing at this time of year. So be well, be happy, and we will catch you on Tuesday. Gina and Judy, it's all for you.